Today on the 21st, the phrase critical race theory has taken off in American politics, frequently used to attack many different teachings on America's racial history.
I've never figured out what critical race theory is, to be totally honest, after a year of talking about it. They're teaching that some races are morally superior to others, that some are inherently sinful and some are inherently saintly, and that's immoral to teach that because it's wrong.
Well, today, we're going to figure out what critical race theory is and what it isn't. We'll talk about how conservative politicians have weaponized the phrase, and we'll talk more broadly about what students in Illinois are being taught on race. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. America has been in a clash of cultures for decades, or you might argue, going back to the founding, or even before. And the latest front in the so-called culture wars is the once obscure academic concept known as critical race theory.
It's anti-American training that vilifies white people and demands they apologize.
The best learning for students about social studies and about our democracy and our country is the learning where students can really grapple with the issues and really come to a deeper understanding of how our past informs our present.
All of this revisionist, woke curriculum, you are not going to do this to our children.
That montage assembled by the Washington Post for an explainer video they posted. Critical race theory is certainly having a moment this year, at least as a phrase. Last weekend, Saturday Night Live opened with a parody of Sesame Street. Actor Aidy Bryant was playing Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who created a more Republican-friendly version of the show called Cruz Street.
There's also three terrible letters, C-R-N-T, critical race theory. And I think it stands for Caucasian rights trampled. That's why the Proud Boys have been invading school board meetings to keep CRT out of our classrooms. Please welcome two of the Proud Boys, Bert and Ernie.
Many Republicans, though, on a more serious note, have pledged or voted to ban the teaching of critical race theory, or what they think is critical race theory, in elementary and high school classrooms across America. But critical race theory has a specific academic definition. It's a framework often taught in law schools and other parts of higher education that's used to examine cultural bias. It is not a catch-all term for any teachings on race. Well, today we're going to spend our entire program trying to understand what critical race theory is, why it's become weaponized in politics, and what examining race and racism in a classroom actually looks like. Joining us to talk about this are Emily Knox, professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and the author of Book Banning in the 21st Century, I should say Book Banning in 21st Century America. Emily, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Hello.
We're also joined by Adrian Dixon, who's a professor in the College of Education at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of the book Critical Race Theory in Education. Adrian, welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for having us.
And I'd also like to welcome back Joseph Flynn. He's the Associate Director for Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the Center for Black Studies at Northern Illinois University. He's also the author of White Fatigue, Rethinking Resistance for Social Justice, not to be confused with the Robin DiAngelo book White Fragility, which kind of had a moment last year. Joseph, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here again.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
A bit later in the conversation, we're going to hear from Daniel Vock, who's a public policy reporter who's covered how critical race theory has been used in politics. But for now, listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. What do you know about critical race theory, or CRT as it's been abbreviated? How do you feel about it and the debate surrounding it? Do you have questions for our guests about the term, how it's been used, why it's been so highly politicized? Join our conversation by giving us a call. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. 800-800-9455. We've already got text messages and voicemails from some of you. We'd love to have your calls, though, as well. 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21ST Show. Adrienne, I'm going to begin with you. Let's just begin with a basic definition. And sometimes I like to say, if you can explain it to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old, what exactly is critical race theory? What are the key ideas there?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So critical race theory is a way of trying to make sense of what we would call phenomena. So why do certain things seem to happen over and over again? And for a subset of people who study inequalities, we try to understand why there are persistent inequalities, particularly after we've had a series of legislative acts that are supposed to have addressed that. So the Brown v. Board is a famous one that addressed racial segregation in education that impacted a lot of other domains. It certainly influenced the Voting Rights Act and all the Civil Rights Acts. So we still see that there are disparities in educational, in access to education across the, you know, from elementary through college, through graduate school. We see disparities in employment. We see disparities in housing, access to housing. And so we try to understand that, again, in light of these legislative acts that were designed specifically to address them, why do these disparities persist? And so critical race theory was a way of trying to understand that, that was different from analyses that tried to account for it because of class differences. So because someone earned more money than another, we could see perhaps there are these disparities. And so despite that, the disparities historically have persisted along racial lines and impacted particular racial groups. And so that's what CRT was really designed to address, is to try to make sense of these persistent disparities that existed regardless of class background and in many ways, regardless of race, regardless of gender.
And can you talk, Adrienne, a little bit about where it originated, the legal mm-hmm. scholars who were behind the original sure. idea?
Yep. So so CRT has its origins in legal theoretical scholarship. So legal journal, academic journals. Derek Bell is probably the most famous critical race theory scholar. He passed away, I think, in 2012. Kimberly Crenshaw is another. Kendall Thomas, Patricia J. Williams, Mari Matsuda, Charles Lawrence, Dorothy Roberts. So there are, you know, there were quite a few legal scholars, and it started in the late 1980s or mid 1980s, and kind of grew out of that, out of legal scholarship. The first kind of import into another field was in the early 90s into education by my doctoral advisor at the University of Wisconsin. So Gloria Latson-Billings, Bill Tate, Danny Solarsino at UCLA, Larry Parker at the University of Illinois, who preceded me in this job. Larry is now at University of Utah. So its origins are in the legal field, and it spread into education. And then from education, now it's kind of a number of other fields have picked up critical race theory to, again, make sense of kind of disparities across a number of domains that seem to track along race. So we have, you know, critical race theory scholars who are in public health, who are looking at this in psychology. So again, it spread to a number of academic disciplines that have been concerned about, again, disparities and inequalities that we can't account for just through a race, through a kind of class or gender only analyses.
Emily Knox, I want to ask you about sort of the path that critical race theory took. So we've talked so far about how it started in sort of the law schools, and now it's moved into other academic disciplines. And then suddenly in the last year or two, it's in the mouths of everyone, it seems, everyday people. It's on cable news, and now it's being used by conservatives around the country. And to get into this, I want to play a voicemail from one of our listeners. This is from Joe.
The hoopla about critical race theory is just a dog whistle for racism. Since the Johnson administration, a majority of white voters have only voted for Republicans in over 50 years. This is the last vestige of hope for them to bring up issues, to bring out people to vote. Critical race theory is graduate school work. It's law school work. It's not something that happens in the elementary school level, or secondary school level, even in community college or for undergrad. So there is, it's more about the American thing, racism. Let's just leave it at that.
All right. Thank you for that message, Joe. So, Emily, he gets kind of into the history of voting, white voting in America here, and I want to get back to that. But can you just tell us what exactly happened in the last year or two to sort of take critical race theory out of the academy and make it something that, that some people are seeing every night on their cable news shows?
So I think Joseph is correct that this is a continued dog whistle about racism in America, but I think what's actually happened is that people are using critical race theory in a way that has nothing to do with the legal theory at all. What they are actually talking about is a reevaluation of how we understand race in America. And I really think that comes out of primarily the response to George Floyd's murder and the protests that happened. For example, you know, there weren't just protests here in Champaign. There were protests in the majority white towns that surround Champaign. So for example, in Mahomet, especially by young people. I also think wrapped up in that was the 1619 Project actually became quite prominent. And I think people conflated the work of the 1619 Project with critical race theory. What was most interesting in the piece that you played from the Washington Post was this idea that the critical race theory, quote, vilifies white people. That's not really what critical race theory is about. I would say that it's more about centering people who are not white. And that's not even what the legal theory is talking about anyway, but that is the feeling that people have, that something has shifted in our society. It was exacerbated by the pandemic itself. And we are moving from a society that existed before where there wasn't centering of people who are other than white to a place where actually our kids are very involved in thinking about what does it mean that my country allows someone to be murdered so brutally in the street on video. And it's that shift that I believe the people are reacting to. They're just calling it critical race theory. That's an easy thing to say. It's about race. It uses the term critical, which they can link to things like critical theory, which they can link back to Marxism, which is always a boogeyman here in the United States.
Okay, so thank you for that. Joseph Flynn, I want to bring you into the conversation now and talk about another marker here beyond the murder of George Floyd and the resulting protests that followed that is the New York Times 1619 Project, reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones. Can you talk about how that played a role in this conversation and this idea of changing maybe who is at the center of discussions of American history?
Yeah, thank you for that question. The 1619 Project is a podcast done by Nicole Hannah-Jones and the New York Times, in which the episodes, you know, kind of help us understand this history and these events or you know, aspects of American history connected directly to slavery and how slavery functioned, what grew out of slavery, the impact of slavery, et cetera, et cetera. And it's you know, I have to give it a plug to a certain degree because it is an amazing piece of work. But I think, you know, it got caught up in all of this, especially as, you know, politicians like former President Donald Trump and many others began to connect it to critical race theory and use it as an example of critical race theory. And unfortunately, again, they were misapplying the term critical race theory in, you know, fairly vicious ways. And it's really unfortunate because I think folks, if one sat to really listen to the 1619 podcast, you'd come to find that the ideas aren't all that scary, for lack of better terms, but are truly instructive and can help us, you know, understand how did race rise in the United States and what are the vestiges of slavery? How is it or why is it that we continue to need to talk about something like slavery? As painful as that is for anyone, it's still nonetheless something that we have to understand if we are truly interested in understanding race relations in the United States today.
All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about critical race theory, both how it's come to be sort of a catch-all phrase for teaching about race, but also actually what it really is. We're speaking with Joseph Flynn from Northern Illinois University, Adrienne Dixon and Emily Knox, both from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, about what critical race theory really is. And we want to hear from you out there. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455. Even beyond the idea of critical race theory, what do you think about what your children, if you have children or if you happen to be a student, why are you not in class? But if you have, what do you think about what is being taught in high schools today, in particular, about race in America? 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about critical race theory today, what it actually is and what it has come to be a sort of an idea for, especially in conservative political and media circles. We're speaking about that with Emily Knox, who's a professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. Also Adrienne Dixon, who's professor in the College of Education at U of I Urbana and the author of Critical Race Theory in Education. And Joseph Flynn, who's Associate Director for Academic Affairs at the Center for Black Studies and Associate Professor at Northern Illinois University and the author of White Fatigue, Rethinking Resistance for Social Justice. 800-222-9455. If you want to join our conversation today, that's 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. And I want to read a couple of texts we got from our texting group on this. We asked our listeners what they know about critical race theory, CRT, what they want to know, and what they thought about it. And one of our listeners, Juanita, texted us, "I believe this racial thing has been going on long enough. Anyone can be treated good or bad. I believe it's what the person does, and if they stand by our wonderful USA. If you don't like the USA, then leave. We love our country, and those who work to care for their family take pride in the USA and have faith that they can be welcomed here in our country. Love us or leave us now." Again, that was one listener's comment. Another one of our listeners, Franny, texted us, "In the United States, we have issues besides racism. There's discrimination for race, religion, gender, sexual persuasion, class, and who knows what else. How about we teach our children to treat everyone with respect and treat everyone fairly?" So, Joseph, can you respond to the sentiment in those messages? I mean, when people you know, here, clearly people hear critical race theory, and I think some people think, boy, didn't we deal with all these issues, you know, with the you know, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act in the 1960s. What do you say when you hear people express those sentiments?
Well, I mean, that's a part of the reason why critical race theory was created in the first place anyway, right, from the outset, because, yeah, these, as Dr. Dixon had pointed out earlier, yeah, we have passed a lot of laws and policies that have attempted to help solve our problems around race, but despite those policies and laws being passed, we still continue to see inequitable outcomes for various communities, particularly African-American, Latino, and Indigenous communities. So it's not enough to say, well, let's just be nice to each other. That kind of puts all the onus of racism and racist practices onto the back of the individual alone without recognizing that we all operate within a larger context. We're all operating within systems and institutions. So if we're not examining how systems and institutions function and cause inequitable outcomes because of policies and practices or loopholes within the law, then we're not really doing the work that as a society that we need to do to ameliorate racism. Now, I do think it's important that, you know, we kind of balance this notion of, you know, people need to, you know, try hard and work hard and so on and so forth. And I get that. And I don't have a problem with that. But with that being said, we have this very, very clear history going all the way back even before 1619 of inequitable practices and, dare I say, oppressive practices against some groups compared to others. And if we're not telling the truth about that, then we're not really doing the work as a society that we need to do, again, to solve these deeply rooted problems.
Adrienne, I wonder if you want to weigh in on that as well, what the listener had to say there about that sort of love it or leave it idea of America.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think what's interesting is that, you know, Obama gets credited with saying this, but this is, you know, we're to be a more perfect union, right? And that requires that we engage in a kind of constant national reflection, and we're always remaking and redoing things that we need to do to make sure that this is a more perfect union, right? So we have not yet wrestled with our racial history fully. And you know, it's a misunderstanding of critical race theory to think that they only think about race. The critical race theorists consider race and how it's mitigated by a number of other factors, including race, gender, sexual identity, citizenship status, et cetera. So Kimberly Crenshaw is kind of credited with bringing in this notion of intersectionality and that people don't live just these kind of singular lives. I am a woman of color. It's clear when I go places that I'm not a white woman, and I've had experiences where it's very clear to me that I'm not a white woman and I will not have the same kind of advantages as a white woman. Assumptions that people make about me when I had my children, that I was unmarried, uneducated, and unable to care for my children. Those, you know, I've had, those were assumptions because we have deep-seated beliefs about people in groups. That's a part of the kind of master narrative about particular groups that we're always trying to address and act against, if you will. And so the disparities that we recognize are sometimes are often, as critical race theorists, we try to make sense of them in light of these kind of longstanding narratives. If I were to ask my students, give me a profile of a professor, I wouldn't typically be that profile, right? I wouldn't fit that profile. For most college students, a professor is a white male, a white, able-bodied, English-speaking, heterosexual, Christian male, and not someone like me. And so if you know, we are working against, again, these longstanding narratives that cast who is American and who isn't. And one of my colleagues was saying that, in fact, his name is Julian Vesquez Halick. He's the dean at University of Kentucky. That in fact, you know, we could argue that those of us who push and challenge are probably more patriotic than we get credit for, because there is a desire to make America live up to its ideals and its mythology, again, about being a more perfect union. So I reject this idea that because I level a critique, that I need to leave, or that I'm, you know, somehow not American enough, or that we are being unpatriotic. The very, you know, inception of the US came from people who were dissatisfied, who pushed and were unhappy with how they were being treated. That was a segment, and it's ironic that we reject the criticisms and the pushing and the nudging of groups that have historically been oppressed, even while people were fighting against their oppression. So I reject that argument. I think that it's simplistic in terms of understanding the nuances and the complexity of what it means to live in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to go now to the phones at 800-222-9455. Peter is calling in from Peoria. Peter, thanks for calling in. Oh, all right, maybe not. Doesn't sound like we have a good connection there. Emily, let me ask you. Peter was going to mention about African-American history textbook called Black History 365 in resistance to the book in the area. But Emily, let's talk a little bit more about books. We're going to talk about the Virginia gubernatorial election a little later in the program, but I do want to talk about a campaign ad that Virginia governor-elect Glenn Youngkin ran. He campaigned as being against what his idea, or sort of the popular conservative media idea of critical race theory, is. Let's listen to the clip.
As a parent, it's tough to catch everything. So when my son showed me his reading assignment, my heart sunk. It was some of the most explicit material you can imagine. I met with lawmakers. They couldn't believe what I was showing them. Their faces turned bright red with embarrassment. They passed bills requiring schools to notify parents when explicit content was assigned. It was bipartisan. It gave parents a say, the option to choose an alternative for my children. I was so grateful. But then Governor Terry McAuliffe vetoed it twice. He doesn't think parents should have a say. He said that. He shut us out. Glenn Youngkin, he listens. He understands parents matter.
Okay, again, that was a campaign ad from the Virginia governor's race. Emily, I know you've written and thought about this. Your book is Book Banning in 21st Century America. The book in question there, I don't think it mentioned it, was Toni Morrison's Beloved. Can you talk about how the idea of banning books has become entwined with this idea of attempting to ban, you know, what people think of as critical race theory in state legislatures around the country?
Sure. So book banning is something that I've long been interested in. And actually, I wanted to mention that the title of the book is not mentioned explicitly in that particular segment, because you might think that the person is talking about some sort of tawdry romance or erotica, and not a book that has won the Pulitzer Prize, just by thinking about the idea that they use this word explicit. You're like, well, what is explicit about the book? How is it related to critical race theory? So what has happened in America's schools is that the canon has been shifting for quite some time. And books that were originally introduced into college curriculum is slowly moving down into both high school curriculum. So Beloved is a good example. Beloved is on the AP reading list. So if you go to the testing board, you'll see that it's one of the books that they actually call out for students to read. It's not generally on regular English classes. They tend to read The Bluest Eye instead of reading Beloved. So how is this wrapped up into issues about critical race theory? So when I talked about the idea of centering, this is a way of saying that we should be reading as a society more than just books that are by white men. There are other voices that we should encourage our students to hear as they, in order to be educated people, to be good citizens. And so that gets wrapped up in critical race theory because it often involves people who are of different races, including Toni Morrison's Beloved. I'm just always interested in this because I think the phenomenon of book banning is one of the more interesting that happens in this country. It's often quite futile, and it really talks about the actual values that we want to transmit to our students. It's rarely about the book itself. It's often about something else that's happening in society.
I want to play another voicemail we got. This one is from Elon Jones, who's a sophomore at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, on her thoughts on teaching critical race theory.
Hi, my name is Elon Jones, and I'm a sophomore at UIUC. Critical race theory is an academic movement that allows for students to understand the divide between race and law in the United States, and then make judgments on how American racism has shaped our legal systems and public policies. I personally believe that critical race theory should be taught in middle school and high school. It is important for Black students and students of color to understand their history and for others to learn of the unethical behavior so that the pattern no longer continues.
Okay, so you have, these diverging views out there. You've got some white parents calling for the banning of books and Black students calling for teaching CRT in middle and high school. Joseph Flynn, where do you stand? I mean, at what age group should these ideas, critical race theory, be introduced?
Well, I think ideas of critical race theory, like interest convergence or intersectionality or the idea of counterstory, which are the three primary tools of analysis for critical race theorists. I think those ideas can be taught at younger levels, at younger ages. And you don't necessarily have to throw the kitchen sink, so to speak, at a third grader, but we can talk to third graders about how would you feel if your story wasn't taken seriously, how would you feel, or what does it mean when people's stories are not heard, or the depths of a particular group or individual's experiences are not being represented. We can have those kinds of conversations with children, because if there's one thing that's true about children is they have a very, very keen sense of what's fair and what's foul. And they do have the capacity to think critically, as long as the foundation for them to think critically is properly laid in the classroom. So I personally would not necessarily talk about it in terms of we are going to teach, a fifth grader critical race theory, because as we've been saying, critical race theory is a pretty complex form of legal analysis that is now used in a number of other disciplines. But the ideas that we learn from critical race theory, we can share with students in classrooms as a way of helping them understand these larger phenomenon. And the notion that, you hear a lot of people say, my kid came home and he was upset, or she was upset, and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the reality about children is they're also very resilient. And you know, with the right kind of structuring, with you know, some hand holding and that kind of thing, they can have these conversations about race and racism.
All right, we're gonna have to take a break. We're gonna continue this conversation about race and racism and critical race theory and what it is and isn't. After a short break, you're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're spending the entire show today talking about critical race theory, what it actually is, the actual academic framework that it is, as well as how that phrase has become sort of a political rallying cry, particularly on the right. We've been talking about this with Emily Knox, who's associate professor in the School of Information Sciences at the U of I Urbana-Champaign, author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. Also, Adrian Dixon, professor in the College of Education at U of I Urbana and the author of the book Critical Race Theory in Education. And Joseph Flynn, who is Associate Director for Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the Center for Black Studies at Northern Illinois University, and the author of White Fatigue, Rethinking Resistance for Social Justice. We want to hear from you. 800-222-9455 is our number, 800-222-9455. And I also want to welcome into the conversation Daniel Vock. He's a public policy reporter who's covered critical race theory, specifically how the Virginia election results might foreshadow potential strategies and even outcomes for next year's Illinois political races. He's also a longtime friend of mine. Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So, Dan, exit polls in Virginia showed that the education and critical race theory, they were important issues to Virginia voters, but, you know, exit polls aren't always the most reliable thing. So can you talk about the weight of critical race theory in that election and what it might tell us about Illinois' races next year?
Sure. You know, we took a look at, for the Center for Illinois Politics, how the Virginia race might foreshadow discussions that we'd have in the Illinois races coming up next year. And I think one thing that is clear, whether or not the exit polls showed it, is that Youngkin's candidacy really took off because of dissatisfaction about schools generally. That was critical race theory. It was actually a lot of what they were calling critical race theory. It was actually started in a lot of local districts, some very big districts in the Washington, D.C. suburbs were revamping their curriculum, including more diversity and inclusion efforts, which are not critical race theory, but sort of got lumped in with them. And there was, you know, backlash among white parents about sort of those directions. So I think Youngkin was able to capitalize on that to build some momentum. As you may know, Youngkin was the first Republican to win statewide in Virginia in more than a decade. So they really sort of needed an issue to help them stand out and to get, you know, Republican voters motivated. What we saw in Virginia was not a depression of the Democrat turnout, but Republicans seemed to turn out in even greater numbers. So so this was probably an element of the enthusiasm element. But again, I would say that the critical, the race component was certainly part of the motivations, but there were lots of issues around schools about lockdown.
Right, like COVID. Yeah, COVID. And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah. It wasn't it's hard to parse what was this and what was that.
Yeah, a lot of parental dissatisfaction, I think, as well, just about, you know, having to homeschool their children or at least, you know, supervise their Zoom school for their children. But you know, certainly Republicans are taking a message from that election. And there was an email that went out to the Illinois Republican Party's fundraising list about a week ago. It says, "Friends, last week, Virginia rejected the radical critical race theory curriculum by electing a governor who believes in parental rights. Here in Illinois, we've been fighting back against CRT and our billionaire bully governor for months. If we've learned anything from Virginia, it's that we don't have to sit back and let radical leftists tell our children they're in one of two unalterable groups, oppressed and oppressor. We can and should fight back. The left wants to impose racist ideology on our most vulnerable populations, and they're starting with your children. It goes on, but Dan, you spoke with the chairman of the Illinois Republican Party for that story for the Center for Illinois Politics. What did he have to say about critical race theory?
Well, he brought it up as an example of something that would get parents involved. And you have to remember the Republican Party in Illinois doesn't have many offices. They don't have, you know, statewide office holders. So they're looking for issues that are going to generate enthusiasm. So he did not have any specifics as far as examples of what he considered critical race theory. Had said that there were some examples in the suburbs. And in fact, since our interview, there have been stories about parental outrage about books, and it actually had to do with the LGBTQ issues rather than race. But the point being, I think what they're looking for there is a way to energize, especially suburban voters, most likely white suburban voters, and bring them back into the Republican fold.
All right, Dan. So you've been covering critical race theory all year, at least back in May, when Republicans from 20 states were sending the Biden administration letters against, you know, what their conception of CRT is in the 1619 Project. This didn't just happen sort of out of the blue. And I want to play a quick clip of Tucker Carlson on Fox News.
I've never figured out what a critical race theory is, to be totally honest, after a year of talking about it. They're teaching that some races are morally superior to others, that some are inherently sinful and some are inherently saintly, and that's immoral to teach that because it's wrong.
So Dan, as a reporter, I mean, how much do you think that the media, and particularly conservative media ecosystem, contributed to these, you know, quick attempts that rose up in the last year or two to sort of ban and really repurpose the term critical race theory?
Well, I think a very big role. I mean, it's hard to say it's just the media. It's kind of this echo chamber sort of effect. So there's a gentleman named Christopher Rufo from the Manhattan Institute who has credited himself with bringing this to the fore. But what he did is look at
I have his tweet from March. He said, "The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We've decodified the term and we'll recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans." I mean, he basically, that's the playbook right there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot of framing, as they would say out here in D.C. And so he was on Tucker Carlson's show, and within weeks, then President Trump issued an executive order, which has become the basis for all these legislations. So in state legislatures, noticeably, they don't often ban critical race theory. What they ban is quote-unquote divisive concepts, which are not critical race theory, but they are things like, you know, that you're supposed to not be able to say that America is inherently racist or inherently sexist, or make people feel bad about their racial group that they belong to, which are all sort of cribbed from the executive order that President Trump put out and President Biden rescinded. So yes, it's the media amplified by public officials and then sort of picked up from there. So it's a lot of self-reinforcement.
Okay. Well, Dan Vock, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st. Appreciate it.
Sure.
All right. We're going to return and finish our conversation out with Adrian Dixon and Emily Knox, both from the U of I Urbana, and Joseph Flynn from Northern Illinois University. Adrian, can I get you to respond to some of these, you know, political uses of the phrase critical race theory? I wonder if that is, you know, affected you as somebody who actually teaches the actual concept. How is that playing out in sort of the actual academy as this has become so politicized?
Sure. I will say, luckily and fortunately, you know, at the University of Illinois, we value academic freedom. So I haven't had any direct pushback by anyone that I work with. I have received hateful emails that I have forwarded to our public safety, some threatening sexual violence, which is typical of the ways that people attack women and women of color. Others accusing me of fomenting racial violence and bizarre, attributing bizarre kind of issues to me and my work. But I have forwarded them when I've received them, and it's been over a couple of years this year has been particularly active. Other times I've received emails from, I think it's a campus conservatives group that emailed asking about journal articles that were published on a journal that I sit, I'm on the advisory board for. I have given and will give a talk for some state educator groups, and one that we're preparing for, executive director decided to make it a webinar and not just a regular Zoom session where people can, we're going to shut off the chat because of feedback that he's gotten. And it's one of these, you know, kind of what is CRT? And again, people think that we're kind of trying to indoctrinate people into CRT and teach them CRT or make them become CRT scholars. And no, we're not, but, you know, kind of responding to what's happening across the country, and just for educators, for school, I've spoken to school board organizations and principals associations, because many of them just don't know what critical race theory is. So they are as surprised as a lot of us about the kind of pushback and fervor and anger that parents have about critical race theory in schools. And they're like, well, we don't even know what it is. And so I've worked to kind of explain that for them. And then to the extent that I can help them think about strategies.
Only about 3 minutes left in our conversation. Joseph Flynn, let me ask you, what some of the things that are being taught in schools, right? The Illinois legislature passed a law requiring schools to teach an extended version of Black history going back to 3000 BCE, pre-enslavement, going through slavery, the American Civil Rights Movement. Can you talk about, you know, what is being taught in Illinois schools and, you know, how that differs from other states, right? I mean, is this considered progressive in Illinois? And Joseph Flynn, if you're still with us,
I'm sorry, you're muted.
Yep. Okay.
I accidentally muted myself. More schools are beginning to ramp up their capacity to be able to teach a broader understanding of African and African American history. And I think this is an important step because it's about reclaiming a sense of humanity for African Americans and representing African Americans much more accurately in the curriculum. You know, Africans weren't born slaves. Africans were enslaved. And so what's the story behind that? How do we understand that story? And telling that story, we also get to stops along the way, like where does whiteness come from? How did people become white? You know, what's the process of assimilation for European ethnic groups? And I think that's really crucial. And so, I think as we begin to, you know, go forward with this initiative, we have to be cognizant of teaching about not only slavery, but also Jim Crow laws, convict leasing, the lynching era, a number of Supreme Court decisions that had negative consequences on not only African-American communities, but also other communities like the indigenous, as well as Latinos and Asians. The phenomenon of redlining, you know, all of these were federal policies that are easily accessible, right, to read and find out about. And we have to start introducing these concepts to students in K-12 so that when they come up into higher education, they have a much much firmer grasp on what this history is, what it's about, and perhaps through that, see their neighbors in different ways and recognize that the problems that we are dealing with are very, very long problems that can be solved, but we have to have that information and that knowledge up front. Otherwise, we're just spinning the same old record.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Joseph Flynn, Adrian Dixon, and Emily Knox, thank you so much for being with us and having this important conversation today on the 21st. I learned a lot. I hope our listeners did as well. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. Once again, Joseph Flynn is on the faculty at Northern Illinois University, the author of White Fatigue, Rethinking Resistance for Social Justice. Adrian Dixon, professor in the College of Education at U of I Urbana, author of Critical Race Theory in Education. And Emily Knox, associate professor in the School of Information Sciences at U of I Urbana, the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. That is all the time we have. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.